jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little low, by golly. Then we'll put them in the follies. By jingo, said by gosh, by gee. By Jiminy, please don't bother me. So they all went away singing, oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jelly.
Hello, and welcome to the American Writers 100 Pages at a Time podcast. And in this episode, I will begin talking about Black Boy, American Hunger. It's Black Boy and then American Hunger in parentheses after it. This is Richard Wright's memoir, I guess. Now, I've heard that elements of this are fictionalized or exaggerated. Like, I can imagine the killing of the cat scene earlier in this book, in which his dad tells him, kill that cat. He does, and then he's punished for it because his dad didn't really mean to kill him, but he took it literally. Like a scene like that, I mean, I have no way of knowing if it's drawn from life or if it's fictionalized. You could make a case for either, right? So I think you kind of have to say, you kind of have to take this book at face value. Now, if you read this alongside the biographical notes that every Library of America volume has at the end, you know, it more or less matches. And the period I'm going to talk about today covers his birth, essentially, or his very young childhood, till 1920. So until he's about 12 years old, right? And I don't know if I'll go point by point. It's really only three chapters here, four chapters, although they're fairly, some of them are fairly long chapters. An important point throughout this period is he's moving around a lot and he's facing a lot of extreme poverty. And at the same time, he's learning what it means to be Black in America, right? Which is an experience that all Black youth had to go through, especially in the Jim Crow years, but still to this day, where racial consciousness, racial identity is kind of forced upon them, right? That's, you know, it's something that they don't have a choice of, right? It's something that society kind of gives them and forces them to take. It's not a choice. And that's a lot of what is struggled against. It's in the title, Black Boy, right? That's his identity is as a Black boy. Now, there's a lot of really moving stuff here. For instance, at the end of chapter three, where Richard Wright talks about his mother's illness, we get a really wonderful passage, which I want to read with you. It's kind of as a way of beginning this look at this book. My mother's suffering grew into a symbol in my mind, gathering to itself all the poverty, the ignorance, the helplessness, the painful, baffling, hunger-ridden days and hours, the restless moving, the futile seeking, the uncertainty, the fear, the dread, the meaningless pain, and the endless suffering. Her life set the emotional tone of my life, colored the men and women I was to meet in the future, conditioned my relations to events that had not yet happened, determined my attitude to situations and circumstances I had yet to face. The somberness of spirit that I was never to lose settled over me during the slow years of my mother's unrivaled sufferings, the somberness that was to make me stand apart and look upon excessive joy with suspicion, that was to make me self-conscious, that was to make me keep forever on the move, and though to escape a nameless fate before seeking to overtake me. At the age of 12, before I had one full year of formal schooling, I had a conception of life that no experience would ever ease, a predilection for what was real that no argument could ever gainsay, a sense of the world that was mine and mine alone, a notion as to what life meant that no education could ever alter, a conviction that the meaning of living came only when one was struggling to write the meaning out of meaningless suffering. At the age of 12, I had an attitude towards life that was to endure, that was to make me seek those areas of living that would keep it alive, that was to make me skeptical of everything while seeking everything, tolerant of all and yet critical. The spirit I had caught gave me insight into the sufferings of others, made me gravitate toward those whose feelings were like my own, made me sit for hours while others told me of their lives, made me strangely tender and cruel, violent and peaceful. It made me want to drive coldly to the heart of every question that lay open to the core of suffering. I knew I would find it. It made me love burrowing into psychology, into realism, and naturalistic fiction and art and those whirlpool of politics that they had the power to claim the whole of men's souls. It directed my loyalties to the side of men in rebellion. It made me love talk that sought answers to questions that no one else, that could help nobody. That could only keep alive in me the enthralling sense of wonder and awe in the face of the drama of human feeling, which was hidden by the external drama of life. And that's how chapter three ends, with this wonderful passage that you can't help but think of Bigger Thomas in here, and especially the essay, like how Bigger Thomas was born. Kind of that desire it's really hard to describe, isn't it? Like, the language here is very, the language is simple, but the feelings it's trying to convey are kind of complex and really difficult to deal with. Like, this loyalty to men in rebellion. He talks about this in the little essay about the creation of Bigger Thomas, where, you know, Bigger Thomas's kind of, you know, fascination with fascism was just a response to, like, just resist for resistance sake almost, right? Because what else can you do in this situation, right? A steep skepticism about this. Now, the very next chapter of this, chapter four, is about religion. So after his mom gets sick and is recovering from her illness, he goes and he ends up living with his grandma. And he's very, very poor during this point of life. Now, he's constantly poor throughout his youth. He grew up poor. His father was poor. And his father leaves his family for another, you know, he goes to join with another woman. So he doesn't have his father anymore, and his mom has to go live with, like, their aunts. And his uncle is killed by some white supremacists because he owns, like, a bar or something. It's, like, really horrible stuff that he's constantly facing, all in his young childhood, in his formative years. But he comes out of this with this, like, deep skepticism, and that's what chapter four really is about, is his relationship with Seventh-day Adventist, which is his grandma's religion. And he just treats it like almost like a joke. He eats pork. He doesn't follow the dietary rules. He's, he doesn't listen to the teacher. None of the teachers, like, 20, and he's 12, so not much older than him, but he has this deep contempt for his teacher, threatening violence against her. And it's all coming from these experiences that he has as a child. And it's, again, it's really hard to put into words. You sort of have to read it and just feel it and experience it. I think that's the power of the book. I'm not going to attempt here to try to explain, like, line for line what he's trying to say. He's not making a formal argument. It's very much like Native Son in that way, where we feel we're just in this 100% emotion. And this emotion is, like, toxic and kind of horrible to experience, but it's, like, ever-present, and you can't escape it. Of course, in Native Son, it's reduced to, like, fear and hate, right? I think it's even more complex here. And we see evidence, I think, of his moving towards in a more existentialist philosophy, right? Because the idea of existentialism being that, you know, your nature comes to you through your experiences and the choices you make, right? And for Black Americans, those choices are extremely limited by the material conditions in America at the time. So he's more of a product, he's made by America. And this is all out of that, his resistance, his rebelliousness, his hostility towards his family members, his sarcastic, cynical, angry attitude towards Seventh-day Adventism, right? Whatever your feelings about that religion are, he's a young boy being sort of raised in this faith, and he just has this deep chip on his shoulder, right? It's the same when he talks about his relationship with other young boys that he meets. And this is kind of after he's developed a consciousness of himself as Black, right? And he's associating with other Black boys. And again, it's full of kind of an infrapolitical resistance, right? In just the way they carry themselves and kind of will themselves through the day. It's full of this hostility to everything around them. And again, this very much reminds us of Bigger Thomas, it seems to me. Now, chapter one is, I guess I kind of was reading this backwards, and I probably shouldn't. Chapter one, now part one of this book overall is called Southern Night, and it makes up the bulk of this 300-some-page book dealing with his childhood. Part two, The Horror and the Glory, deals with his movement to Chicago, and I think that was added in a later publication, so the original publication of this book was only a short 250 pages or so. But then he added this other part, and it became this version of it, Black Boy, American Hunger. But anyways, chapter one in part one really covers the period from his birth to 1917, so till he's about nine. And this is the period in which his father's, the main figure in this section is his father, and the impact of him leaving, his father leaving, had on them. And it basically made their horrible situation worse, right? Now, the father is very aloof, very like a violent man, or prone to scolding and violent, like he verbal assaults against the kids constantly. He has Richard Wright, as I suggested before, kill a kitten. They're playing with a kitten, him and his brother, his younger brother, playing with a kitten, and his father comes in and says something just like, get rid of that kitten, kill it. And Richard Wright, as a young boy at that time, probably five or six, sets up a little noose and hangs this kitten. And the description of this death, it's pretty hard to read. It's pretty horrible. And then he's punished by his father for doing this. And he's just like, well, you told me to kill the kitten. And he's like, well, you know what I meant. I just meant scared away or something. And this is almost believable that this is going to happen, right? Where, you know, a father orders a kid to do something but doesn't really mean it, right? Like, get lost. They're like, why don't you just run away? And sometimes kids take that seriously, right? If you know the Erik Erikson stages, right? Young kids are still in that stage where they're conflicted between like what's expected of them and what they can do autonomously on their own, right? I forget the names of the different crises, but one of the earliest ones is about the ability to do something autonomously on your own versus doing what's expected of you by your parents. And he's not overcome that stage, so he just says, if dad wants me to kill the cat, I got to do it. And for that, he just gets punished more. And this father is not a good person. He's a sharecropper. He's incredibly poor. He can't really support the family. And he's not really there for Richard. Richard starts drinking at 6 years of age. He sort of becomes a bit of an alcoholic at six. That is documented, and he seems to grow out of that to a certain degree. But we know Richard Wright had alcohol issues later in his life. So in some sense, he probably never fully got over that. But eventually, his father just leaves him. Now, he's not presented as like a very attractive man in any way. So I don't know how he got this other woman or what's behind that. But he does leave his wife and kids for some other woman. And he's just out of the picture, and he's basically starving. Now, he's not far away. He's still in the neighborhood. And at one point, Richard Wright is asked to go get money from him to help them move to where do they go to? Is it, I think it's Tennessee or Arkansas, someplace like that. No, Jackson. They go to Jackson, Mississippi. First they go to Memphis. The family moves to Memphis. They moved to Memphis, and that's where he's deserted. His mom starts to work as a cook. I had to look at the biography to get the details on this. But but the point is, at the end of chapter one, he actually goes back to see his father, and it's really heartbreaking because you want to respect your father, and at the same time, you know, most parents fail in many ways, right? And as someone grows up, especially if you haven't seen them in a while, right? Whatever heroic image you had of your parents is shattered by the reality of their life, right? You see them as they are as you get older, right? Especially if you're a successful writer like Richard Wright, it's that contrast is harder to avoid seeing. So he writes, a quarter of a century was to elapse between the time when I saw my father sitting with the strange woman, this is the one he leaves him for, and the time when I was to see him again standing alone upon the red clay of a Mississippi plantation, a sharecropper clad in ragged overalls, holding a muddy hoe in his gnarled, veined hands. A quarter of a century during which my mind and consciousness had become so greatly and violently altered that when I tried to talk to him, I realized that through the ties of blood, though ties of blood made us kin, though I could see a shadow in my face, in his face, there was an echo of my voice in his voice. We were forever strangers, speaking a different language, living on vastly different planes of reality. That day, a quarter of a century later, when I visited him in my plantation, he was standing against the sky, smiling toothlessly. His hair whitened, his body bent, his eyes gazed with dim recollection, his fearsome aspect of 25 years gone forever from him. I was overwhelmed to realize that he could never understand me or the scalding experiences that had swept me beyond his life and into an area of life that he could never know. I stood before him poised, my mind aching as it embraced the simple nakedness of his life, feeling how completely his soul was imprisoned by the slow flow of the season, by wind and rain and sun. How fastened were his memories to a crude and raw past? How chained were his actions and emotions to the direct animalistic impulses of his withering body? From the white landowners above him, there had been nothing handed to him, a chance to learn the meaning of loyalty, of sentiment, of tradition. Joy was as unknown to him as was despair. As a creature of the earth, he endured hearty, whole, seemingly indestructible, with no regrets and no hopes. He asked easy, drawling questions about me, his other son, his wife, and he laughed, amused when I informed him of their destinies. I forgave him and pitied him as my eyes looked past him to the unpainted wooden shack. From far beyond the horizon that bound this bleak plantation, there had come to me through my living the knowledge that my father was a black peasant who had gone to the city seeking life, but who had failed in the city. A black peasant whose life had been hopelessly snarled in the city and who had at last fled the city. The same city which had lifted me in its burning arms and borne me towards alien and undreamed of shores of knowing. End quote. So that is, that's a pretty profound story, and almost makes this book like worth reading on its own for some of these passages. Really heights up poetry. I mean, brutal, vulgar stuff throughout this book, but also like these moments of brilliance and exaltation in writing. And it's just such a powerful moment, at least in my view. So after he has this pass, he talks about his time in Memphis. Then they move on to Jackson, Mississippi, where he stays with his grandma. And this chapter, too, involves him learning to read, but also a lot about him learning about race and learning a little bit about black history through his grandparents. His grandparents were slaves, but his grandfather, I guess this is on his mother's side, was all four of his grandparents were slaves, but at least one of them was served in the Union Army during the Civil War. So you can imagine that, you know, those experiences and stories that he got. But there's a lot here about just learning that he's black and learning how to interact with others. And it's something that's sort of taught to him by the elders, even though it's kind of in a mocking way and they tease him about kind of how ignorant he is about racial realities. It is them teaching him the kind of the rules and that he's going to have to follow. You know, there's a section about like seeing prisoners and they're wearing black and white. And he asks about that. And he's like, why are so many of them black? And it's like, well, the law is harder on blacks. And this is explained to him. We also get like this anti-Semitic doggerels that he's learning through his different interactions with people. So there's kind of a culture of anti-Semitism that he's exposing here, that he's exposed to. Now, eventually they go, they stay in Jackson for a summer, and then they go on to Arkansas. And that's where he's living with like his aunt. And if we jump to the chronology of his life, Maggie Hoskins is the person he's living with, and she's married to this saloon keeper, a bar owner, Silas Hoskins. And around in the time of World War I, remember, this is a period of a lot of racial violence in America, right? Especially 1918, 1919. Hoskins was murdered by whites who wanted his liquor business, right? So this is right before Prohibition time. So that might be, I don't know. Even then there were some like dry counties, and it's entirely possible this was a dry county. But Silas Hoskins is murdered, and this is in the story as well, talked about. And they have to end up fleeing to another city and living with some other people. So the image we get of them is sort of always on the run, right? There's times that Richard Wright spent in like an orphan asylum, the Howe Institute. He eventually, in 1919, 19, 18, gets to start going to school. They're settled enough that he's able to start attending school. But by this point, we really, you know, especially at the end of the section, we get the narrative of that's the deep bitterness he's feeling about the world around him and how it interacts with him and treats him. And the part of this is poverty. Part of this is, he's growing enough. He's old enough to kind of put together somewhat he's feeling, right? He starts to feel, I think someone like Erik Erikson, because I've just been thinking about him, I think could do a lot with a book like this, because it does seem he's undergoing some of the crises, the stages of life, you know? And it's entirely possible Richard Wright was somewhat exposed to some of these theories of psychology. I mean, he obviously was influenced by existentialism by this point, and, you know, that's, you know, that's something that we see influencing this text, it seems to me. I don't know. I just think you got to read it. I think it's worth reading. It's really, really, it's excellent, and it's very impactful, and powerful stuff. I don't know. Not much more to say. I'm sorry about that. Maybe I should have took more careful notes. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just wing it, like I am today. Sometimes I do have more detailed notes. Usually I wing it, but usually I have at least some more marginal notes. I didn't have that. I just kind of gobbled this up. But anyways, next episode, we'll look at chapters 5 through 13, I want to say, which will still be in that part 1, Southern Nights. And then the final episode on this chapter will finish up Black Boy, which will see him kind of enter into adulthood. Yeah, that's more or less the plan. So the chapters will be shorter, and so there'll be a little bit more. Maybe I'll try to document a little bit more of my reading experience to share with you. But I don't know. A book like this, maybe I kind of have to reflect on the whole thing before I have anything else to say. Yeah, so anyways, let me know what you think if you've read Black Boy. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this early part. In the next episode, I'll continue digging into it. So in a few days, I'll be back with some more of my reflections. So anyways, thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Every night, they sang in the pale moonlight. Oh, by gee, by gosh, by gum, by jaw. Oh, by jingo, won't you share our love? We will build for you a hut. You're gonna be our favorite nut. We'll have a lot of little, oh, by gosh.